Welcome to Cut the Bull, an insightful podcast which addresses the news of the day and the cultural issues plaguing our society, bringing logic and context to these topics and discussing solutions too real for mainstream pundits. Now, here are your hosts, Charles Love and Wilfred Riley.
Hello and welcome to Cut the Bull. I am Charles Love alongside my co-host Wilfred Riley, and our guest this week is Larry Schweikart. He is America's history teacher, historian and author of several books, former college professor. Those books include Dragon Slayer, which I don't see behind you, but that was a good one. A Patriot's History of the United States, which is in its fifth, is one of the most successful American history books in its fifth edition, 41st print. And he's joining us this time to talk about his most recent book coming out this month, A Patriot's History of Globalism, Its Rise and Decline. So I hope there's some hope in there, and we get some good stuff at the end. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Charles. Yeah, you're right. We kind of tout this as part history, part hope. I mean, I think one of the biggest problems facing people who want change in this country today is a kind of spiritual defeatism that I see spreading. Kind of, they're going to steal elections. There's nothing we can do about school boards. There's nothing we can do to change the woke culture. It's just kind of a helplessness that I see a lot of people have. And there's good reasons for hope here that these people can be beaten and these things can change.
Well, that's great. But let's start at the beginning. So why did you think it was important to write the book? And, you know, what is globalism? I know many people may have different definitions.
Yeah, that's a good question, a good starting point, because one of the things I did was after I looked at what all the experts said was globalism, which is basically control of the masses by a few international elites. Mm-hmm. I asked a whole bunch of people on Twitter, maybe 20 of them, well, how would you define globalism? And they gave me basically variations of that answer, controlled by elites over the economy, over medical facilities, over politics and whatnot. So it has been a big topic in the last 10 years, maybe not too much before then, but ever since you started seeing a lot of news about Klaus Schwab, the WEF, the International Monetary Fund, groups like this, Davos is in the news all the time. People got interested in this, and I thought, let's see what history has to say about all this. So I went back to the Congress of Vienna in 1814, one of Henry Kissinger's favorite meetings, and
looked successful. It was so successful.
Oh, he said, yeah, it's so successful. It put peace in Europe. And I'm going, wait a minute. We had two wars in the next 75 years. You know, how's that successful? But anyway, and then I looked at militaristic imperialism, where basically it was imperialism where you're trying to install global control over Africa, Asia, Latin America by a few elites in Europe. Mm-hmm. Then we went to the Treaty of Versailles, which is really a globalism on steroids, where Woodrow Wilson goes over and with a few cronies there, literally redraws the map of Europe, moving millions of people without any discussion to them of, you know, well, should we be doing this? Do you really want to be Poles, you Germans? Do you Czechs really want to be German? Yeah, it's crazy. Right. And then eventually we get into financial globalism with the Bretton Woods Agreement, International Monetary Fund, World Bank, and of course all of the trade agreements that are colloquially called the dev biz or the development biz. Right. I end up in medical globalism, of course, with the China virus, the COVID vax, and then the WHO, not the rock band,
not the WHO, we won't get fooled again though.
Yeah, the bad WHO, not the good WHO, and end up with climate change globalism with all of the celebrities, and then the last chapter is a chapter about hope. It's starting to unravel everywhere, from Davos to the change in governments to more populist governments to people saying we won't get fooled again with a vax. I mean, those saying that they'll take another vax is down to 1%, right? And so I see a lot of hope out there for resisting these forces.
Well, what are your thoughts on what he said about globalism, whether it be the genesis or how it's being used today?
Yeah, I mean, as a political scientist, I think it's one of the better breakdowns I've heard. I mean, obviously, the interconnectedness of the world has increased greatly over the past century, the past few decades. And I mean, the idea of the nation state is kind of challenged by that, right? I mean, so, and most people don't want it to be. That's the thing. I mean, if you look at the French protests, the Danish protests, I mean, America, go back to the Tea Party, Occupy, most people think they have plenty of problems in their own country and they want to solve their, I mean, they want to solve their own issues among, what's the old definition of a nation, of people living in one place, same people in the same place. So globalism is stoutly resisted by most people, but it is ardently pursued by the elites around the world. And that this is the real, James Lindsay's good on this, our guest today is good on this, but this is the real subsurface cause of a lot of tensions around the world. Why is the curriculum so similar in American and Mexican and Canadian schools containing odd sexual content? I mean, there's probably some obscure UN agency that's drawn this up. I mean, so I guess and our job here is to interview. So I mean, Larry, how do you think increasing globalization and the current state of globalism will impact the USA? What are the biggest threat vectors out there? What's your take?
Well, I would say probably the two biggest threats are the World Health Organization and its attempts to control all medical activities within a society, number one. And number two, I think it's probably the climate change agenda, which I do believe now is on its heels. For the first time in 30 years, I think these guys are on their heels, but still, they're still pushing this 2035 junk. I read an analysis by a British engineer who calculated all of the costs involved in the 2050 goals that they had, and he concluded it would cost, for example, the United States all of its GNP, not its government budget, every penny made by the US for the next 23 years to meet the 2050 goals, which of course can't happen. So those are the two big ones. Some of the interconnectedness of the trade is beginning to unravel as Bretton Woods has just naturally unraveled after World War II for a big reason. Americans are tired of spending money to protect everybody around the world. And we see this with the Houthis. Now, who are the Houthis? Houthis are the Houthis. But the Houthis and wanting to protect the sea lanes there
Right.
in the Red Sea. And Americans are, as are French and Italians and everybody else, are saying, how is this in my interest that I, put troops in Yemen, for example, as President Biden did the other day?
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I got the historian and the political scientist here, so I have to ask, Will mentioned the disconnect between normal people and the elitists. So the elites are trying to do what you described as globalism, and most people, you poll them, they don't like that. Yet somehow those elites are able to convince many people, not the majority, but the ones who are vocal, that what they're doing is a good thing. So if it doesn't sound like it's a good thing, I guess at some point I'll play devil's advocate and say, well, don't we need this? And hear your response to that. But if people don't think it is, how are they so successful at convincing us to think that we do need, one education system across the world, one financial
Here.
system, one met all the same medical rules, even though the climates are different and the people are different and all those kind of things? How do they convince people to go against what they really believe when polled,
Well,
even if
I'm sure Will would agree with this, that one of the reasons the elites are so powerful is they have so much money. I mean, the top 1% of the people worldwide control something like 50% of the wealth. And I know you can fiddle with statistics. I dealt with this myself over the years. I understand. But nevertheless, with that much money, someone like a single person, like a Bill Gates, can dramatically influence what happens in Rwanda or Angola or someplace like that by inserting millions of dollars into a country that amounts to maybe a small part of their entire GNP.
right.
They can buy advertising. They can, like Rupert Murdoch, can own Fox News and promote whatever globalist ideas he wants, open borders and so on. And so it's very hard to resist, but there is this major disconnect, and we see it not only in polls, but we just see it whether it's in school board meetings, we see it in popular protests. And as any time in history, the people ultimately have the power. It's just at what point in history do they recognize they have the power and begin to act on it? And we saw this last week in France, that or in Brussels. That was amazing where these farmers go in and they say, no, we're not leaving till you change the regulation, which they caved in and did the other day, but we'll see how long they stay at it. I think they may need to keep those tractors parked there in Brussels for a year or two.
Right, right. Anything you want to add, Will?
I mean, so I think there's an interesting dynamic here. So what you find if you survey elites globally, I mean, like the 1% was the old line from Occupy and the Tea Party. That's the group you said has 50, 51 to whatever percent of the world's wealth. If you survey elites, they tend to think of themselves as world citizens. Mm-hmm. That's a phrase that I've only heard unironically used on like the campuses of fairly elite colleges I was speaking at. Like my own University of Illinois was near the bottom of the tier of places where people would say some shit like that unironically, but Harvard, Yale, Claremont colleges.
Right.
The Africans actually have a term for this, Wabenzi, in the rising African countries. It means like tribe of the Mercedes. So like most people, but like most people in Nigeria or something like that would be like Waigbo, which just means like black man of the Igbo tribe. It's like, okay, cool. They're no more or less racist about it than we are. But like a Wabenzi is someone who's forgotten his tribe, forgotten his village, forgotten his home city, the provincial capital, and moved to like Lagos or down the continent to Cape Town or maybe to London, and identifies himself with his, you know, Mercedes and his wife, who's an equally, you know, deracinated person from like Italy or Ireland. There's nothing wrong with any of this. But there's a very identifiable term that they have for the elite. And I think it's very funny and very descriptive. So you often get the Wabenzi, like the guy from Nigeria, the guy from Japan, the guy from Britain, and the guy from Scarsdale, will see each other at certain locations, perhaps Ibiza as young men, who view themselves as more members of one group than they view themselves as being linked to the people in the hinterlands in their own society. And the terms that you hear in Japan and Nigeria actually are grossly similar to the terms you hear here, where it's common to call Trump voters, you know, toothless rubes and all this kind of thing. People will just post pictures from Trump rallies to like the comment section of the New York Times to make some kind of point, like these ordinary looking people are his voters. Why do people go along with this message from people who at some level perhaps dislike them and who are in a competitor social class? I think it's what you call the cool kids effect sort of in high school. Like, it's very difficult to challenge the ruling class because if you get successful enough at it, the ruling class can just offer you membership, first of all. Why don't you go out for the team this year? You know, and secondarily, they tend to control the apparatuses that get out information. So like when you look at the media, last thing for me, but like the climate change agenda to me is crazy. I mean, the sort of things that are coming down, like all cars will have to have some electric component by what, 2025. They're insane. They're Stalin-esque regulations on businesses in a free country. The reason people are cool with that is that they legitimately think the world is going to end. If you talk to young people, you'll often hear things like, we only have 12 years. AOC has said this. This is a catch line in college environmental groups, like on the stand. So who's telling them that? Probably the group of people that have this agenda. Of course, we're not all going to die if temperatures rise 2 degrees.
Right.
Well, you know, and the last chapter of my book, the chapter on globalism, I quote maybe 15 or 20 of those people, and they all have different years, and they keep moving the years every year, right, another year or two out. But yes, you're absolutely right that they do see themselves as having more in common with someone from another country who believes as they do, as opposed to their own countrymen. The old thing in America had long been flyover country, although that's disappearing a little bit because we're getting more of an urban, non-urban division here in the country, that people who actually kind of have to do something besides sit in a pod all day are starting to, you know, have different ideas. But yeah, it is hard to mobilize, and the apparatus is in the hands of the elite. However, again, some of the good news is that over the last 30 years, the media has begun breaking down. We had a great story about a week ago from Taylor Lorenz that said, oh, the media is failing, they're collapsing. I'm going, yay! And that's the best news I've heard this week.
So the other thing, go ahead, Will.
One very quick comment there. Like the one thing that a point that Larry's made about this, the agenda 2035, which used to be agenda 2028 and all this other bullshit. I mean, like, I do think that those of us on the right who tend to be kind of cynical businessmen do need to understand there are actually threats to the planet. You can't throw your trash directly into the Cuyahoga. We saw what that turns into, right? But these doomsday predictions, we've been hearing these for 50 years and they've always been wrong. And that is some context that if you're an investor, military leader, anything like that, you need to take into account when you're looking at, you know, a near future threat assessment here. Like the book, The Population Bomb, like we're going to overload the environment and we're going to overpopulate the planet. We're all going to die by 1980. That was Paul Ehrlich. It came out in 1968. Still the second best-selling book ever in the social sciences. He was just wrong. I mean, his predictions were things like India is going to collapse. India is a nuclear power. They're maybe the eighth-ranked country in the world. So when people are wrong at this level over and over again, there have been 9 peak oil predictions so far. You know, you have to start looking at this and saying, okay, what makes us think that this time you're not just trying to panic us to get some kind of global agenda through? You're not just even trying to do something that might be good, a new environmental bill, but you actually fear destruction. And I haven't been convinced about that on climate change. I mean, there are companies that build seawalls. There are obvious ways we could respond to a 4-foot rise in sea level over 100 years.
Well and, you know, I talk about the Mayflower and the people arriving at Plymouth Rock. And when I give that lecture, I say, by the way, here's a picture of Plymouth Rock. It's still there.
It's still there.
Because the oceans know that it's an important national symbol. So the oceans keep their rise away from Plymouth Rock to preserve the national symbols, right? But, you know, I'm totally with you. And I think there's a big difference between being concerned about obvious threats to the environment. We remember when it's in The Reckoning by David Halberstam that Ford Motor Company at the Rouge River plant would throw so many spare parts into the rivers. There were rivers in Ohio where you could literally walk across the river on the discarded parts of autos. That's outrageous. That should never happen. But
that's
a whole
cool,
lot
though.
Different than saying that somebody driving a car is going to cause your temperature to rise 4 or 5 degrees when you look up and see a solar flare that by itself will change the world's temperature somewhat, right?
Right.
But I think... Well, one of the most interesting things is this, why don't people believe the evidence in front of their eyes? And there have been numerous social science studies on this, that sometimes you get to a point in society where they will not believe actual factual evidence no matter what you show them. There's a term for this. I forget what it is. You probably remember. But they get this internalized thing that says, well, I'm just not going to believe that. And a lot of it, just to go to a biblical perspective, is that people don't want to admit they're wrong. Because once you say I'm wrong about one thing, it means you possibly could be wrong about a lot of things. And so they just kind of dig in and say, you know, oh, no, planet's going to rise 10 degrees in temperature if we don't stop it now.
Right. And of course, if you can make up a number and no one challenges it, and, right, and you don't get penalized for moving the goalposts, why wouldn't you do it? Now, I want to go to when you break this down, you talk about why all of these different attempts from militaristic to diplomatic, all these ways, why they all failed. And mm-hmm. I'll give you a chance to explain why in a minute. But Will, I want to go to you first and say, maybe this may be part of Larry's explanation as to why they failed. But one thing I find interesting, a reason that they could possibly fail, is that we talked about the two groups. So we talked recently about is Black History Month, talking about culture and you know, Black culture and all these other cultures and African-American, I mean, Asian-American, Hispanic, all this culture. So at the same time, what people are trying to say, they're trying to push that we're world citizens. You know, we need equity. We need everybody to be the same. Then when they pare it down a layer, everybody goes back to, well, we want to, you know, hold, which is totally fine, and preserve our particular culture. So you can't really say that we're all the same, but then let's highlight all the stuff that we're different. So from their end, they kind of realize that they're saying one thing on one hand and the other. But then on the elite's end, they're trying. Now, I talk about, you know, Larry was kind enough to let me write a blurb about the book. And what I talked about was the different ways they did it, right? So some of them wanted power and control. Some of them really thought they were helping. But when they realize it's not helping, right, they won't admit that they're wrong, like you said, and they double down. So you have them doing these things. My favorite, he talked about his biggest concern being the WHO and medical and those things. But the ones that most glaring to me are the financial and the DevOps, right? So everyone knows you flood all this money to these countries. They don't get the money. It doesn't help. No one talks about it. They rinse and repeat, right? So from that standpoint, they're failing. Basically, because they're not really concerned as much about whether it works or not, as they are about what it feels like to be doing good quote unquote. And so that is that part of the problem that you see, Will, in why this attempts to make the world all even, why it fails.
Sort of. I mean, one of my basic points is that it's important to have an honor code in life, but it's also important not to take abstract moral principles too far. Many of them aren't ultimate in any real sense. So when you say, and there's a reason I'm rambling about this, but like when you say, for example, do no harm, that can't extend to enemies in war, that can't extend to prey animals. Like when you begin to take that to its logical extent, you run very rapidly into the law of diminishing returns. Like you start doing things that don't make sense. Like you have humans eating an all vegetable diet and living for a shorter period because you are not doing harm. And that the results are absolutely negative. So I guess like a lot of the things that the elite believes are stupid. In fact, elites, Tom Sowell is pretty good on this. I mean, he points out that elites are on average smarter than the ordinary, again, country lawyer or skilled housewife, but only by about 5, 6 IQ points. And they're a very small group. They're, again, half of 1% of the population or whatever. So they're prone to stupid, faddish ideas. And I mean, this goes back over the ages, courtly love and the more innovative religious cults and so on. And today, the woke stuff seems to kind of play that role. Like, that's very much an upper middle class on up belief set. So the idea that like every group with its own haircut is entitled to a nation state is something that seems to be popular in the UN when I read the transcripts of their recording of their proceedings. Most people understand that that's very problematic, that like an all black or all redneck or whatever America, Appalachia as a country would rapidly be a third world state. I mean, the Mexican border states by themselves and so on. So, if they're serious about that, yes, the elite focus on this stuff, like gender ideology, is going to be very damaging to any project of unifying the world. Like the Islamic world, Muslim men, and I'm totally with them on this, aren't going for that at all. The question really is whether that stuff is taken seriously or whether it's kind of a distraction. Like how much money does the UN spend on gender identity programs in Pakistan as versus how much money do they spend on Agenda 2035 or whatever? I mean, I would say it's probably, $1 to $2,000. Like there are serious amoral guys like Bill Gates and a sheik and a former British prime minister in a room that are coming up with plans that will impact what you can drive. And I know how much like Azerbaijani self-recognition really gets into those meetings. That's kind of the parasite that rides on the big bull when you look at how this plays in corporate America. So the only problem is that it is very damaging if you're on this. Actually, this is a good last sentence. A lot of the things that are very damaging if you're on the ground, like mass immigration. I went to a high school, East Aurora Senior, that was mostly tough black kids and tough white kids through like the 80s. In the 1990s, we had mass migration, and we started seeing a lot of tough Hispanic kids come in from south of the border. This East Aurora is now about 40% Hispanic. The results are what you'd expect. There was a lot of extreme violence and also a lot of love relationships and so on. I love Hispanic culture. But the actual impact on this working class neighborhood was pretty negative. And I don't think that the people that were authorizing mass immigration at that time, that people were signing NAFTA, relaxing the border, really knew or cared that that was happening. When I got to U of I Law School later on, most of the people that I talked to, their impression of immigrants was like, oh, they're such great nannies. And I imagine that would be more intense on the East Coast. Like they didn't have to fight them. Like they're great guys. Like we all get along now. No one's wearing their Percy Jackson boxing anymore. But that was a real negative experience that doubled crime in that community. So I think a lot of this stuff is kind of tacked on to bigger agenda issues, but it has a real impact on the ground. I guess that would be my point. The
They're
gender thing, for
great
example, of
nannies.
10,000 kids so far.
They're great nannies. But Larry, so talk about in the book why you say they
Are
fail,
they really, man?
and then piggyback that to what's different in general, why they fail, and then piggyback on, your four pillars of America and why America is different.
Well, you had mentioned the financial. We've been talking about
Yes,
the
yes.
foreign aid and that kind of stuff. And I think this is probably one of the few areas where at least some people recognize that they've failed. You've got people like William Dichter and Thomas Dichter, William Easterly, people like that who used to be in what was called the dev biz and know how it works, and have been writing tell-alls and exposés showing that this money doesn't accomplish anything that it purports to do, and often causes far worse dislocations to the native people that it's being foisted upon. But not just that, things like Tom's shoes. There's a great video from Acton Institute called Poverty Inc., in which they look at groups like Tom's shoes that go in and deliver shoes to all of the natives. Well, that's wonderful, except now you've driven out the few shoemakers or the few shoe producers who were in that area who would be there 2 years later when Tom is all gone. You know, it's somewhat comedic, if not tragic. You remember Sam Kinison would go into this routine about somebody filming the poor child in Africa with the flies all over. And he goes,
yes,
you're standing right there. Give him a sandwich. And so I think they are starting to see that. The problem, though, with the dev biz is that now there are thousands upon thousands of these workers in all these countries whose living depends on them, quote, helping others. And so there's this entrenched bureaucracy now that has to feel good about what they're doing, whether it is or not, because their very livelihoods are depending on that.
You're talking about admitting it. Wasn't there a major, was it Live Aid? Wasn't there a major contract where they raised all that money and they had to admit that none of it would, that was probably the big open fiasco that everybody knows about, right?
Well, virtually all these organizations are like that. Their overhead costs often eat up 80 to 90% of their budgets. This is true even in many churches. You know, it's always because the motivations supposedly are good. Now, I don't trust Bill Gates' motivations, but he says he's got good motivations. So, all right, he wants to help people, maybe. Ronald Reagan used to have this great saying that the worst words in the American language were, "I'm from the government, I'm here to help you." And now we could apply that to do-gooders like Gates and others, like the people at Davos. And it's a real danger now. Again, I think people are seeing through it. But what Will mentioned is exactly right. There's different ideas about, you know, if you're living in Beverly Hills and the only interaction you have with illegal aliens is your landscapers, that's one view. But if you're living on the border, as I am here in Arizona, and you see what's happening to society, to the schools and so forth, that's a totally different view.
Right, right. And then you were going to talk about why their attempts don't work and the differences between the countries and the people, and point out the four pillars from your other book that's really important about what makes America unique.
Sure. The reason they don't work is they never really ask the people what they want. They act from top down. And the four pillars of American exceptionalism, pillar number one is a Christian, mostly Protestant religious tradition. And the reason that's important is because it's bottom up church governance. It doesn't have anything to do with theology. It has to do with how you run your churches. Right. And the second one is common law, which is bottom up political governance. And almost all of these countries and almost all of the elites don't believe in either of those things. They're notoriously anti-religious, and they don't believe in common law. Very few of them have come from a country that has common law. If they're from Europe, none of them have common law. If they're from the colonies, former colonies, none of them have common law. People wondered why the vax people, the administrators, were so tyrannical in Canada and Australia. And the words I would constantly hear is, aren't they democracies? Yes, they're democracies, but they have no experience with bottom-up democratic principles because England governed them top down as part of their empire. So even though supposedly Canada and Australia are democracies, they haven't had as much practice at being a democracy as we have. We've had almost 300 years in practice in being a democracy.
Right. You know, one thing I wanted to say, Will, I don't know if you remember this, but Will wrote a piece, I don't remember who it was for, about American exceptionalism. And then they asked several other people to comment on his piece and write a piece about whether they agree or disagree. And so I wrote a piece about America's greatness and in reply to Will's piece. And what I wanted to do was say something that most people don't do, because every time you talk about America, especially on the right, they make the mistake. It's not that they're wrong. America's great because of the Constitution and the founders, you know, did this, and because of all these other political things, which are true. And I said, some of it's just dumb luck. So I talked about the geography.
Yes.
And I laugh because there's interesting things in Larry's book that you'll learn. Like he talks about Napoleon. So there's a deep dive in that whole thing of trying to oust him, but can we kill him and make it martyr? What you should do about that? And when he talks about this, goes into detail about what the actions did for DevOps, what they did in the medical area. And I thought about this piece because you wrote about that. And I said, well, some of America's greatness is just simply, I don't know, we got 20% of the fresh water, right? There's a difference between our rivers like the Nile and Amazon along rivers, but they're not navigable. They're not the same. So I wrote this a couple of years ago, and you put that stuff in the book. And I'm like, that's exactly it. So in addition to the four pillars, the private property, and you talk about those four pillars from the standpoint that no country, no other country were founded on them because they were older, right? And
Right.
then that no country today has all four.
Right.
So you have that. You mentioned two. I don't think you finished the other two. So the other two were
The
private
other two
property
are
with
private
written titles and
properties,
deeds.
written titles and deeds, and
Yep.
that's very important because there's a lot of places in Africa where they have private property, but they don't have a system of written titles and deeds. And then the last one is a free market
Yeah,
economy.
that we used to
But
have.
yeah, but when you got absolutely on the geography, and this is a point that where I kind of differ with Peter Zeihan, who goes into this really well about the geographical advantages that America has. I mean, his big point is that there's probably a collapse coming, but America's going to be the least affected by the collapse of almost any country because of all these natural advantages, the navigable rivers, the dynamic, incredibly big consumer market, all this kind of
Right.
stuff. And that's absolutely right. But I would say that one of the reasons America has that and was able to take advantage of all this were the four pillars, that we had people who were set and able to develop steam engines and use them on the waterways, or
Sure.
to develop the McCormick Reaper, or to build railroads without government support, as James J. Hill did it. And so as a result, yeah, we have all these advantages, but they would not mean much if we didn't have a religious and political and economic structure that allowed us to take advantage of those advantages.
Right. Well, what do you think about that? How we have, those advantages in the thing. Like one great example would be Russia being such a large country, but they don't have a lot of supports, right? So they don't have a lot of points of entry where you can bring stuff when you talk about trade and commerce.
I think that this is almost a bit of a different topic than globalization. But why did some countries rise to dominance in the current international regime? Yeah, I mean, some of it, like I'm not a total rejecter of the great man theory of history. I mean, some of that is the founding fathers. I mean, we had some of the greatest geniuses of all time gathered together, and some of two, I mean, Washington, Philadelphia, and some, I mean, of Boston. Of the maybe 100 cities in the world at the time, and they wrote the Constitution. You had Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, Governor Morris. I mean, just scrolling down through the actual list in the document is an impressive reminder of who started the country. But yeah, the basic point is that those boys couldn't have done this in Somalia. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the leading nations in the world, they're all, even countries that are incredibly incompetently governed, such as Egypt. I mean, they have 3,000 years of history. They've got the Nile River. Like, they're not going to screw up that badly. They'll be there in another 1,000 years, But the major nations, China with the Yangtze, the Yellow River, and the greatest rice growing region in the world. I mean, a fantastic coast. Japan as a enemy slash rival offshore to compete with. The USA. I mean, the USA is a continent. I mean, so the New World nations like America and Brazil, I mean, were ripped out of the New World, like this whole new area that was discovered when Europeans came over here and, fought some of the bravest warriors ever, but people that were using stone-tipped arrows. So, I mean, blacks and Hispanics aren't from here either, took it, basically. So, I mean, the Brits got Canada, which is that great taiga, that boreal forest up there. It's a beautiful country, but it's too cold to live in. We got the central portion of the country, and the Spaniards, the Mexicans, got the bottom third, which is again nice land, gives some jungle, but a lot of it's desert. We also took the top half from them because they started it when we won the war.
Right.
So the old Mexican joke is the USA stole half of our country, and they stole the half with all the paved roads. So we wound up with just the most productive of the three chunks of land ripped from this continent by conquerors. And that obviously is a major predictive reason for American glory. You can't just say, well, it's the idea of democracy.
Right.
Ethiopia is a, surprisingly well-governed, fairly high IQ, democratic state. It's in the desert and their neighbor Somalia. I mean,
Will, it's funny that I taught my next door office mate was taught Mexican history, and the phrase he always used was Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States. But I will push back on this. When the English colonists started, if you had looked at a map of North America, Central America at that time, Spain had all of this stuff all the way up into California. France had all of Canada down into the top part of the Mississippi River. And the English colonists were on these two little narrow strips of malarial swamp and rocky land along the ocean. And I would say to my students, which of these three would you just kind of naturally think was going to win this conflict? Mm-hmm. And it would be anybody but the English. But the English colonists won it for a lot of reasons, because of private property, the written titles and deeds that went out to ordinary people, which the Spanish did not have in Mexico, and which the French refused to give out in Canada because they didn't want to interrupt their trade relations with the Indians. The point is that all of these things fit together, right, and they're cohesive, and that's why we have history and kind of not a narrow sociology that can explain one element but can't explain all elements working together.
Right, I get that. Go ahead, Will.
Oh, no, I said, yeah, basically that's right. I mean, so obviously one of the reasons that modern America, like post-World War I America, became a world power is that we had the resources of a continent to draw on. But yeah, I mean, it was brilliant and sometimes conniving leadership by the founding fathers, the military men around them and so on, that first beat off the English, where we, to some extent, introduced guerrilla warfare to the continent, fighting with native troops alongside us and so on. Then, I mean, Jefferson, Louisiana Purchase, we bought, stole, acquired, got through treaty. We didn't just rip off all the great native tribes. That's a calumny. But I mean, we got massive areas of land over and over and over again. And we got another massive tranche of land during the Mexican-American War. And that was obviously all due to good leadership. Yeah. And the something, I mean, Larry's point is something I hadn't really thought about that much. The utilization of the land did require basic practices that were more common in British descended countries. They still are when we study them, than they are elsewhere in the world. So, I mean, private property and other things that you might not think of, like patents and trademarks and so on, is an essential baseline for really setting up any kind of modern industrial economy. So, yeah.
Yeah, and you encourage people to go out and develop additional land where the others, you had no incentive to go west, young man.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, also, like, even leaving aside the black slaves, who everyone talks endlessly about, we also kind of went around the world like Shanghaiing young men with false promises. Come over here, and, you know, work for 23 years, and you'll be free and a blacksmith, me lad. You know, so I mean, one of the things that the USA did was bring over this endless stream of young male warriors, Ireland, Scotland, Norway, this quote unquote squareheads of Minnesota, just sending them over here. And I mean, like, in most of the Indian Wars, more whites died than Indians.
Yes.
I mean, I just read, you know, Not Stolen. It's a fascinating book, honors the warriors on both sides. But it's like fighting Rome, right? We had this endless stream of young warriors coming from these places in the world that the Iroquois and such couldn't even imagine. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, an American army could be beaten to some extent, and we would just put another one into the field.
Yeah, let me make two points about that. First of all, I mean, that's exactly right. But one thing that we did do that no other country that I could find in human history did is that on occasion we would take some of this land, like Mexico. We had Mexico City. We controlled it. And we go, that's OK. Take it back.
Yeah,
we control Cuba, and we passed a law saying you got to give it back. So we didn't always maintain these big far-flung empires that drained off your military, that drained off your resources. Instead, we said, no, that's too much for us to govern. We're happy to have you take this land back. And then amazingly, and I can't find this anywhere else in human history, we'd win a war and then we'd say to the Mexicans, okay, here's $15 million because we won the war. we're sorry, but here's some money for you. But the other aspect that I wanted to get to, it goes to the patents and stuff that you're talking about. And that kind of comes up to the last chapter of the globalism book. And that is this loss of trust. This loss of trust across the board in the elites, in the medical profession, in the legal profession, because we see a two-tiered system of justice, in the education system. Across the board, and you can see it in any poll you want, there's a massive loss of trust by the public in all of these institutions, the church. And what I find most interesting is in the area of research and patents. There have been studies showing that recently the studies that are being undertaken in funded research are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, of less import, that you're not getting the Teslas or the Einsteins or the people like that. You're getting people making these very minute, maybe important, maybe not, quote, discoveries. And the reason for it, according to the research I've seen, is they're afraid to take the risk. That they don't want to risk being called out by others or criticized or lose their funding. So rather than take on something that might actually be important but could turn out to be wrong, they say, I'm going to stick with something that's safe. And so our level of innovation, our level of invention has been shrinking dramatically as I think the loss in trust in all aspects of society has advanced.
Well, that's a great place to end it. We got a couple minutes here. You talk about the loss of trust. And a lot of the things, it seems hopeless. So I don't know. I mean, you're going to close out by giving us your last chapter and talking about hope, because I see some little things pop up, but I don't know what gives you hope that we can turn all of this around, because it's a concerted effort.
Well, first of all, the populist movements around the world are on the advance everywhere. Hungary, Estonia, Slovakia, seven other European parliaments moved far more populist in the last 2 or 3 weeks. Argentina, where Javier Milei went to Davos and ripped those people a new one, right?
Yep.
And but what's even more important is who didn't go to Davos. You didn't see Biden, you didn't see the Prime Minister of England, Prime Minister of Italy, Prime Minister of France. You saw the second tier people, which also indicates that these people are losing their grip. Second, mm-hmm. you can start to see that they're getting more desperate and they're starting to, well, you can trust us. I think Davos's big, phrase this year was restoring trust, or something, right? Restoring trust to you guys. You see it in the vax. They rolled out a new vax, and only 1% of Americans said, no, I'm going to take that. No, 99% said, heck no, fool me once, fine, but you're not going to fool me a second time. You see it in the law. The Supreme Court decisions and the appellate court decisions, the Fifth Circuit Jarchese case against the SEC, West Virginia versus the EPA. There have been a couple of others that I mentioned in the book, and people are pretty assured that led by Justice Gorsuch, they're going to overturn the Chevron doctrine here coming up in the next year. All of this is a massive assault on the entrenched bureaucracy and deep state and globalist influences within America. So I see tremendous hope on the horizon all across the board, really.
Well, let's hope you are right. He is Larry Schweikart, historian and author of the new book, A Patriot's History of Globalism, Its Rise and Decline. Larry, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you, Will.
From you commies who let know you can't fuck with me. I got a country to save. God bless the US of A. Land of the free and a home of the brave. God get all of the praise. I got a country to save, cause I'm Patriot J and I'm saving a day.